This is an ABC podcast.
Now, Giuseppe, hang on, don't pack up the instruments. I want you and the band to stick around because you're going to learn something. Tonight, the young leaders in Australian media will meet some women with very different approaches, and later on in the program, something that may be lurking back of our minds in this increasingly tense period with, well, for example, China and Taiwan. How does Australia make the momentous decision to go to war? Military historian David Horner has looked at our track record, whether for the Great War or Iraq, and our political leadership at the time, the advice they listened to, and the extent to which our allies shared information are all, of course, crucial. Well, Gladys and Potties, you all know about the domination of the media in this country and others of my old friend Rupert. But the one-page town paradigm in Australia is being challenged by the diversity on the internet, and young people are leading the charge. And tonight we bring you the next generation of media voices, and they're being led by women. You're also going to meet an ethicist who says, enough with the ancients, it's time to listen to young people. So I can't say I haven't been warned. Joining us in the Sydney studio, Billy Fitzsimons, who at the age of 24 has just been made editor of the Daily Oz. It's a social first news platform aimed at a young audience. And with her is Daniel Finlay. Now, Daniel is a 27-year-old writer and philosopher who's working with the Ethics Centre on youth engagement. And joining us from our Brisbane studios are a dynamic duo who make up Cheek Media. It's a multi-platform digital media project analysing the news and other important stuff. I welcome co-founder and CEO Kristen Perizzanotto and Hannah Ferguson, co-founder and chief content officer. They're aged 28 and 24 respectively. But first to my actual living, breathing guest in the studio in Sydney, Billy, tell us about the publication you work for, The Daily Oz.
Yes, The Daily Oz. Well, Philip, thank you so much for having me on here. So yes, I'm the editor of The Daily Oz, and we're, as you said, a social first news platform for young people. And I think that what makes us different to other publications is that we really try to explain the news, and we try to report it in a different way, in the sense that we try to not have any assumed knowledge. We get rid of all the jargon, and we try to explain it to young people in a language that they understand. And we don't talk down to them, we talk across to them. And as I said, we really just try to explain it without any assumed knowledge.
How long have you been around?
So The Daily Oz started by the co-founders Sam and Zara in about 2017, but we really took off amid the pandemic, and they both quit their full-time jobs in early 2021. And then I started in August, September time. So I've been there for about a year now.
And you're funded how?
So there are investors, they just closed their second capital raise, who helped, you know, expand the team. But we also do advertising on our Instagram, on our newsletter, and also on podcasting. And
who would dare advertise with you?
Well, there's so many. I think at the start we were like, please advertise with us. And now we get so many requests every single day. But for us, it's really important to make sure that the people who do advertise with us, the companies that do, that our audience trusts them, you know, and their values have to be aligned with our values as well.
Now to Christian and Hannah from Cheek Media. You've taken a very different approach, one that is, well, decidedly partisan.
Yes, we are very biased. We're progressive and we're not afraid. We don't shy away from it, and also we don't try to cover it up. We are definitely a progressive media platform aimed also towards young people. Young people and women make up the vast majority of our audience.
Progressive and feminist.
Absolutely.
Talk to that briefly.
I would probably say that the idea for Cheek Media is that we're hoping that people are reading the news or accessing the news somewhere like the Daily Oz, where it's social first, very, very removal of the jargon, just very straightforward delivery of the news. And from that, they sort of take off and want to see a progressive position or opinion on the news and use that not as their Bible or, you know, their everything that they think on the issue, but as their bouncing platform for having progressive conversations within progressive circles, maybe with their conservative family members. We don't want to stay constrained to progressive and feminist, but we want to deliver the news and opinion in a way to people that allows them to springboard off the idea and challenge their own viewpoints and challenge that of those around them.
Now, the four of you are involved in one way or another with podcasts, but what's your other primary platform?
Ours for Cheek is definitely Instagram. That's where our biggest platform is. We do have a podcast, a website, and various other social media platforms that we kind of use for slightly different purposes. So the podcast and the articles, we delve further into more deeply into issues, and you know, things like our Twitter and some of our Instagram posts are just more short form content. And a lot of the times we do try to make sure that things are entertaining, because we do like to bring an appropriate level of entertainment, especially when discussing issues that can be really tough to comprehend and stomach.
Now, you make the wild allegation that the Murdoch press is partisan. I'll let that go through to the keeper. But, of course, they're not upfront about it, are they?
No, and I think that's why we created Cheek, with the view of being openly and forwardly partisan. I think the issue is that people are going to traditional news publications with the assumption that it's not offering a bias, and we know that to be untrue. I can't read an opinion piece in The Australian that doesn't, you know, blatantly tell me what the voting position of the writer is usually. I think for us it's coming forward and being honest and open about our prejudice and leading from that point. We're not hiding about we're not hiding or shying away from our views where we sit on the political spectrum, and I think that delivery allows people to sort of find their own political compass and see where their views sit truly.
As you probably know, I'm a Murdoch columnist, but I'm kept on, I think, to create the illusion of pluralism. I have to ask you, how the hell are you financed?
We aren't. We're self-funded, so we don't have a lot of financial backing. We do have a Patreon. We have about a couple hundred very valuable patrons who pay us $4 a month for our content. And we do have, we've just launched some merchandise. So obviously we did see a little bit of money come in from there. And we have been really fortunate enough to be paid for some collaborative posts over the last couple of months. But largely we are self-funded.
I've got to ask, merchandise?
Yes, I'm actually wearing a T-shirt right now that says Rupert Murdoch would hate my newsfeed. So it's funny that you were talking so much about him, our old mate. So, yeah, we launched four T-shirts with some politically charged, socially charged feminist messaging that we sold on pre-order for a week, and sold a bunch of T-shirts which will be on their way to the purchasers probably next week.
Now, Kristen and Hannah, are young people interested in the news? People are always saying they're not.
They absolutely are. I think that what young and youth media are trying to do at the moment is increase people's political literacy and allow people to enter the conversation, whether it be at a baseline level or a very sophisticated level. I think that what we saw in the last federal election is that that young people are desperate to have their voices heard on the political spectrum, and that the politicians haven't been listening. I think that people are feeling like they've been left out of the conversation, and I think that our platforms have really delivered a strong message that young people want in, and they want to be heard. And that Canberra should be listening.
Billy, you're nodding, so I presume you agree.
Yeah, I think that there is that old stereotype that young people don't care about politics, and I just think that that's, I'm not going to swear, but completely not true. You know, there was record youth youth enrollment at the last election, you know, and when we ask our audience what they care about, you know, overwhelmingly they tell us that they do really care about politics and they want to understand it and they want to increase their political literacy.
Daniel Finlay from the Ethics Centre, this is what you've been looking at. What is the double bind that young people face when it comes to engaging with issues?
So the double bind is essentially kind of like a rock and a hard place where young people aren't, they're being put in positions where they're kind of not being taken seriously about some things while also being expected to act like older than their age. They're often expected to, act a lot older. Teenagers are expected to do things that adults are meant to do.
Well, forgive me for interrupting, but I can't help remembering the uproar when with the school strike for climate and the climate change.
Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of thing, like where the messaging from the government was like, go back to school, you shouldn't be doing this kind of activism, where at the same time the government isn't listening to the things that we're being taught in school. We're being taught that the world is changing for the worse and we need to act about it, but they're not.
Nearly 20% of our population is between the ages of 10 and 24, but they're not heard.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the cohort of young people in Australia and also in the world is such a large portion of the population, and they're the people who are going to be affected by the changes that we make in government, social changes, everything like that. And it's overwhelmingly in the research that I've been doing in the last year, it's overwhelmingly like 60 to 80% of young people just don't feel like their voices are being heard. They're not being represented in media, in politics.
Let's go back to the dangerous subversives in Brisbane, Christian and Hannah from Cheek Media. Even though you take a position on issues, you say you don't want people to agree with you. You just want people to engage with you.
Absolutely. I think that when we're putting out an opinion piece, you can't expect that everyone will be on the same page. And I think that part of our sort of marketing and part of the dynamic that Kristen and I offer is that when we make a podcast episode, we don't want to agree with each other. And I think that's why people are drawn to our content. Often we exist within a very progressive spectrum of opinion, but we disagree with each other. And I think what we're trying to model is having healthy conversations with loved ones, with acquaintances, with co-workers about healthy disagreement and having politically charged conversations that don't result in conflict necessarily, but in growth and challenge. And I think that's the aim of what we write, what we talk about, what we do every single day.
Of course, the online space is very combative.
Yes, it is. And we definitely get our fair share of disagreement, is the nice way to put it. We welcome disagreement and feedback because we don't tend to write or talk about anything that we're not sure about. Not saying that we're not open to having our views challenged, but generally if we see people disagreeing with us, it is quite interesting to hear their perspective. But on the other hand, if people are just slinging poo for the sake of it, or, you know, making things personal, things like that, that's not productive and that's a different conversation. We don't get a lot of backlash, but sometimes when we do, it's not very nice.
I get a fair bit of that and I try just to totally ignore it. Billy, back to you, the Daily Oz. Brexit stories up according to how much time people have. Your site literally says, I have 10 seconds or I have a minute.
Yes. Well, it's important to note that, you know, people are busy and so we try to deliver it in a really accessible way and we understand that, you know, that you're referring to our newsletter and also, yes, that's on our website. So people can read it according to how much time they have.
Does it also suggest that young people have ever shortening attention spans?
Well, I think that... yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think that there's a way to cater to that perhaps, yes, they do have shorter attention spans, but then they can then go onto our Instagram or on our website and get those deeper explainers as well. So it's not that we are delivering these bite-sized pieces and not doing the deeper stuff as well. We are doing both.
K&H, how do you tackle the issue of grabbing young people's attention?
honestly, I think the opinions do draw them in. I think that people are very attracted, whether they agree or disagree, to what we're saying, because we usually lead with a very hard-line position and then we develop the nuance from there. I mean, we see it's very easy to predict the responses and where the backlash is going to be coming from. If we're covering the Manly Sea Eagles jersey saga, we know what demographic is going to be sending nasty messages to our inbox. But then if we're talking about something like, you know, Scott Morrison's mini portfolios and roles, we also know what kind of response we're going to get, which is largely positive and in response to our, not towards Scott, of course,
but towards our critique. I can't allow a bad word about Scott Morrison on this program.
There are limits
to my tolerance or intolerance. Now, K&H, when you started Cheek Media, you had a silent third partner whose role, graphic design. How important is design when, well, Instagram is one of your primary platforms?
Very important. And she's still around. She's still with us. And that sounds like she's... No, she's still very much a third partner of Cheek. And we always wanted our platform, particularly on Instagram, to look a certain way. And I guess it is both... It's not very deep and then is deep as well, because we have a very specific picture of our brand and we want that our assets and our content to reflect that. And particularly with, you know, as I said before about being entertaining as it is appropriate for the content, we wanted our branding to have a bit of fun. We like the colours and, I mean, just everyone likes an aesthetic Instagram feed. So sometimes it's just as simple as that, really.
Now, Late Night Live is, of course, a television program, but because of budget cuts, we've no longer got a picture. So explain the sort of the graphic feel, please, please, Hannah. Is it cartoony? Is it happy?
I would say it's happy, but I would think about it in the sense that Cheek Media, it's very cheeky. That's the feel. It's very bright colours, it's patterns, it's collages, and it's usually we put our tweets onto this, we write our articles onto really bright, passionate colours, because if the opinion wasn't enough to draw them in, we really want them to get, you know, attracted to the neon nature of it. But I think it's that when you're clicking across to our profile, it's very accessible in terms of reading ability, but it's also very attractive in terms of wanting to keep scrolling, and that's the idea behind it.
I think it's time for me to remind the listener who we all are. Sitting in the studio with me in Sydney is Billy Fitzsimons, who at the age of 24 has just been main editor of the Daily Oz. Beside her, Daniel Finlay, 27-year-old writer and philosopher working with the Ethics Centre on youth engagement, and from Brisbane, the dynamic duo of Cheek Media, Kristen Perizzinotto, co-founder and CEO, and Hannah Ferguson. Now, Billy, graphics, style, design, important to you?
Well, yeah, I think what I immediately thought of when you were discussing that was that Instagram is ultimately a visual medium. And so the fact that we are delivering our news to our audience predominantly on Instagram means that we do have to make sure that it is aesthetically pleasing. A lot of people know the Daily Oz for its colours. We have a diagonal colour look on our feed. But yeah, it is really important. It also makes it more shareable, which is obviously really important for social media as well.
Daniel, the internet has been a major disruptor in terms of where people get news and information, and it's a place where subcultures flourish. What does this mean for young people, and how do they get their voices heard?
Well, I think it's a twofold issue. One, in the fact that we're kind of talking about young people as a homogenous group, and we're seeing through the internet that they simply aren't. That we don't have the kind of homogenous grouping that older generations tended to have. We have hundreds and hundreds of subcultures, and these different subcultures tend to get their news from lots of different places, like we can see with Billy and Hannah and Kristen's outlets, is that they're looking for unique, personally catered to news outlets to kind of give the information they're looking for.
Billy, your audience is 80% female, but you didn't set out to service an entirely female audience, did you?
No. And to be honest, we are still trying to figure out why that is. I think it has to do with who's been sharing our content. We've had a lot of influencers share our content and then a lot of people from their audience and follow us. But yeah, really interesting. 80% is women, but 80% is also under the age of 35.
K&H, you set out to be a feminist outlet, but do young men engage much with you?
They do. Our audience is about 96% women, so it is a small percentage, but there definitely are men who are continuously engaging with our content, like people that we see pop up in comments and in messages who absolutely engage.
I'm intrigued by this 4%. What do we know about them? Or rather, what do you know about them?
They are quite loud. I would say that as a 4% representation, they are pretty frequent in our comments. And often it's actually having quite open conversations about the way that their algorithm might be delivering them news about Andrew Tate or Joe Rogan or these sort of toxic masculine figures that are emerging in the media. And they're having honest conversations about, you know, what they've learned from our platform. But there, on the flip side, is, you know, a lot will come and go in terms of our content being sometimes too feminist for them, too radical. So we do see people giving us feedback constantly on that push and pull element.
A lot of young blokes would be off with the Batuta Advocate or the Chaser, I guess.
Yes, and we do often think that because, and I think we've had a few conversations since we founded Cheek about how men do like to engage with content. And I think generally speaking, obviously we do have men in our platform, but generally speaking, they will go for the satire, even though that is where they might start learning about a genuine news issue, not just for the jokes. But I think that generally speaking, we are, and naturally just being founded by three women, our voices do just naturally, as is, cater more towards young women.
Daniel, as my gender is hopelessly outnumbered on this program, I turn to you now. Why do you think lots of young men go YouTubing?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I feel like the women on this call might be better placed to answer that, but maybe it's just because it's easier to consume. I'm not sure. I think humour probably has a bit to do with it. It's a little bit more engaging or something like that, and it kind of can capture your attention more quickly. But I don't know. The gender divide on this is kind of baffles me, to be honest.
Hannah and Christian, let's talk about gender diversity. Is it a topic you tackle?
Yes, absolutely. We do talk a lot about, particularly in Parliament, not because that's the only place we want to see gender diversity, but because it is, when it's an elected position, I think that we should be looking at it in a through a slightly different lens, even though I would like to see, you know, people like CEOs and people doing all kinds of jobs equally represented across the gender spectrum. However, I think that when it is an elected position and the people in Parliament are our voice and they're speaking for us and they're making decisions for us, and they should really represent the public in terms of gender.
I think what I wanted you to respond to was not the binary genders, but the wider issues.
I think it is something that we talk about. I think that we've written articles about, gender identity and the gender spectrum in terms of parliamentary responses, in terms of how binary our legislation, how binary in things like the Religious Freedoms Bill that comes in and how that affects, you know, City Point College in Brisbane and the contract that they tried to bring in. We talk about those in the forms of articles and when they come up as news. So we do like to tackle those issues in terms of both gender diversity and the LGBTQIA+ community. So I think we are covering it as it comes up whenever we can and speaking out on that.
Are you doing that too, Billy?
Definitely. You mentioned the City Point College there. We covered that, you know, and the Religious Discrimination Bill. When it comes up, it's absolutely something that we are committed to reporting on, and it's something that young people care a lot about.
Billy, are you also after a larger slice of the young male market?
Definitely. I think that, I obviously believe in a lot of what we do at the Daily Oz, and I think that it is really important for young men to be just as engaged in the news as young women are, and that's definitely something that we are trying to engage young men more.
K&H, do you get much in the way of online hate?
I'm actually surprised by how little we get, if I'm being quite honest. I think that it comes and goes in waves. We saw a lot of it during the anti-vax protests during the pandemic. We had a lot of people messaging us quite awful comments. And then whenever we cover things like culture in football, we get a lot of men and of a specific demographic entry in the comments. I've had personal messages directed about me, directed toward my personal account when we published an article about Andrew Tate, Joe Rogan and Ben Shapiro recently. And basically a lot of the time it's not individual threats. It's not people, you know, I'm going to come after you, but it is more, you have no idea what you're talking about. Please sit down and stop talking forever, which is just lovely.
Billy, I've got to ask you this. Do people of your generation actually watch the news?
Well, that's an interesting question. We actually just put up a poll on our Instagram asking our audience if they trust traditional news sources, and 74% said no, which I only bring up because obviously the 6pm news is a traditional news source. And so, you know, I think the idea that people are...
I was also thinking of the 7 o'clock news with a nod to the ABC.
Yeah, true, very true. Well, I would say 7pm is more doable. Like, I'm never home by 6pm. So to, you know, to expect young people, I mean, I don't know about everyone else's schedules, but I think the idea that people are home by 6pm and ready to turn on the news is quite outdated.
Kristen, do you know whether your generation is looking at the news, whether it's 6 or 7?
Most of my friends don't have a TV that connects to the TV. So it's
I am gobsmacked.
So I moved in December, and until then I lived in a house for 5 years that was never actually plugged into the wall. Not to say I don't, I would more likely read the news on my phone online and tune into something like Four Corners that's, I guess, a bit outside of your typical news. And also I think then, and also to what Billy said, having those apps and having, you know, iView and all of the streaming platforms means that you can fit it to your schedule, which is really important for young people.
K&H, how are you hoping to shape the media landscape in Australia? What are your long-term plans?
Our long-term plans definitely will change with the landscape, absolutely. But we always say that we want to do the same stuff but more. We really like what we're doing. We are really comfortable with the kind of content that we create. We would just like to do it on a larger scale. We would love more people to see it. We'd love to be able to do more of what we're doing, essentially.
Billy?
For us, the big thing for us is trust. We want to be the youth publication in Australia that all young Australians go to, who they trust. And so our long-term goal is to continue to build that trust with the audience, expand the audience, but always make sure that quality is the first thing, is our top, top priority.
I'm afraid to ask this final question because I think I know the answer and it won't make me happy. But K&H, do you know anyone who listens to Radio National?
My grandma loves you. I do know people that listen to radio, but often they'll listen to it through the form of a podcast when it's published later. I don't really know anyone who listens to the radio live except for, you know, my parents used to love a bit of Alan Jones during the day, so that was my childhood. But nowadays, none of my friends do, but my older family members, absolutely.
Billy, as you can see, I visibly paled. Your response?
I would say I actually know a lot of people that listen to Radio National and also radio more broadly. But I actually do agree that it is, for me and for a lot of my friends, we listen to it on podcasts after rather than listening to it live.
Well, what an interesting encounter I've just had with the next generation. And I thank you all for coming on. My guests have been Daniel Finlay, Youth Engagement Officer, the Ethics Centre in Sydney, Kristen Perizzonotto, co-founder and CEO of Cheek Media Co., her colleague Hannah Ferguson, co-founder and Chief Content Officer, and Billy Fitzsimons, editor of The Daily Oz. And please listen to Radio National from time to time. Don't give us up completely. Coming up, going to war, Australia's political decision makers in wars so far. Well, beloved listeners, did you know that in the 19 years to 2003, so that's from 1914, Australia went to war 9 times. And the prospect of war has been mooted, often controversially, of course, in the last couple of years. Now, how that all-important decision has been made in the past to commit our nation to war is the subject of a new book by military historian David Horner. It's called The War Game, Australia's War Leadership from Gallipoli to Iraq. David Horner is Emeritus Professor in Strategic and Defence Studies at the ANU. And this book, well, he's a bit of a Goliath when it comes to books because this is his 37th. David, a pub trivia question. Remind us of those 9 wars. Some are obvious, but others might have slipped the mind.
Yes, well, I took the 90 years from beginning in 1914. 1914 is when we went to the First World War. Then in 1939, we went to the Second World War. In 1950, we went to the Korean War. And about the same time, we were involved in the Malayan Emergency, with more troops deployed as the decade went along. Then we got involved in the Indonesian confrontation with Malaya, which turned into Malaysia. That was followed by the Vietnam War. Then we were involved in the Gulf War in 1990-1991. And then we had 2 wars that we got involved in more recent times, in 2001, Afghanistan, and in 2003 in Iraq. So for that period from 1914 to 2003, it's really 89, but let's call it 90 years, 9 wars.
And you make the point that you could effectively split World War II into 2 wars, the European and then the Pacific.
That is right. The decision to go to war in 1939 was not controversial, although some people have subsequently said, you know, why did we get involved in this war in Europe? And then when Japan attacked in December 1941, there was no question that we had to be involved in that war and Australia became under threat. So in that way, there were sort of 2 wars within the one Second World War.
Now, the decision to commit us to war hasn't always been in our hands, has it?
No, it hasn't. In the First World War, we were still very much part of the British Empire, and we were bound up with the British Empire. So really, there wasn't much choice. You know, if Britain was at war, Australia was at war. It was slightly different in the Second World War, although the government still thought that part of the empire, and as a consequence, Australia would be at war. But of course, it hasn't been quite the same in more subsequent wars where we've had a lot more manoeuvre room in deciding whether we go to war or not.
Now, the next step, of course, is determining the scale of the commitment. And you point out that in World War One, that was pretty much cut and dried before the war had formally started.
Well, that is the remarkable thing. Before it formally started, we had already offered troops to Britain. So the idea of sending forces overseas had really been determined before the actual outbreak of the war. But as the war went on, we then decided to increase our commitment to a level which we found very hard to sustain in the First World War, and that led to the conscription debates and referendums.
Now, of course, in more recent years, since the Korean War, Australia has sought to keep its commitment to a minimum, and I recall John Howard's skill in regards to Iraq.
Well, that is right. Since the Korean War, the Australian government has generally tried to keep our commitment as small as we possibly can while winning some kudos from our commitment. And that was particularly the case in the invasion of Iraq, where our commitment was really very small, but it was very carefully managed because committing very early to the Americans, and the Americans saw them, well, that's great, we've got somebody supporting us. Committing very early meant that we could get some sort of respect from the Americans without making a large commitment.
Now, there's a paradox here, David. Bob Woodward came on the program and told us that John Howard's drum beating was very influential in getting George W. to go forward, and yet he has this manoeuvring skill to minimise potential fatalities.
Oh, that is right. And I wrote in the book that the way John Howard managed the commitment of Australia to the 2003 invasion of Iraq was very cleverly done. And it was very well managed. Well, that doesn't mean to say it was necessarily the correct decision, but the management of it was very clever. And it seems that he had decided very early in the piece that we would be involved. And having decided very early in the piece that we'd be involved, it then had to be managed in such a way that we got the maximum advantage from doing it without having a large commitment of forces, and also making sure that the forces were committed in a way that kept the casualty very, very low. In fact, nobody was killed in that invasion.
The one thing he failed to manage, of course, was public opinion. Now, let the record show, as you point out, that most prime ministers whose call it is or has been to commit us to war had no war experience, except my old friend John Gordon, whose face, of course, bore the battle scars.
Well, it did, but John Gordon, and I've got a quote in the book where he says, "I'm certainly no trained strategist." So he understood that while he might have been a fighter pilot in the Second World War and, as you mentioned, got damaged when his plane crashed, he didn't have any particular expertise in higher-level strategic and defence issues.
Well, that takes us to the next point. It's very important that a Prime Minister trust and respect their chief military advisor. Who is the, of course, the chief of the Defence Force? And then, of course, there are the field military commanders whose job it is to perform in the best interest of Australia. How have we fared with these two different types of military advisers, David?
Well, the military advisor in the past, there were three chiefs in the Army, Navy and Air Force, and more recently we have a single chief, the Chief of the Defence Force. And these have generally been very experienced people. Although early in the piece, in the Second World War, the Navy and the Air Force chiefs were British officers. So we had British officers advising the Australian government on matters of high policy. But more recently, they have been obviously Australians.
But that goes right back to Birdwood, doesn't it, in the First World War?
Now, Birdwood was the commander in the field. He's the commander who's commanding the troops overseas. And he was a British officer. He was actually in the British Indian Army. We had an Australian commanding the forces, and that was General Bridges, who actually had been born in Scotland. But nonetheless, he was an Australian. But he was killed at Gallipoli. And Birdwood, who was commanding the Anzac Corps, managed to persuade the government that he should be the person to command the AIF overseas. So for the next 3 years and more, we had a British officer reporting back to Australia on what's going on.
David, did he stand up to the British Commander-in-Chief on our behalf?
Well, that's the problem. He would be very reluctant to do so because the British Commander-in-Chief is his boss, and he would be unwilling to stand up. And that's why, in the long run, we got a new commander, and that was General Monash, who was more willing to stand up on behalf of Australia.
And a very, very great general as well. Now, in the Second World War, the government selected several Brits as service chiefs, but made a major decision in appointing Thomas Blamey.
That is right. And Blamey was appointed for various reasons. He was appointed because it was thought that he would better be able to handle the political side. But Blamey had been Monash's chief of staff. So Blamey was aware of the problems of trying to command a force that is part of an allied, and in this case, a British force. And he made sure that he had a charter that said that if he disagreed with what the British commander was doing, he could report that back to the Australian government and make sure that Australia's policies were followed.
Now, there was an ominous portent from 42 to 45 because the government's principal military advisor was the legendary and perhaps notorious Douglas MacArthur.
And that is right. And now, I suppose you might say that Australian government really didn't have any option at that time other than to pass the running of its forces over to a foreign, American general who commanded, not only commanded all the Australian forces in the Southwest Pacific area, but also became the principal military advisor to Prime Minister John Curtin, thereby edging out the Australian Chiefs of Staff and General Blamey. And this was not really a very good thing in that obviously MacArthur had the interests of himself and the United States foremost in his mind.
I'm glad you put his own interest first, because that was very much his personality.
Oh, yes. He was very keen to get back to the Philippines, and he saw that as his personal wish. It may have well have aligned with the American government, but it was his personal wish.
Now, there's a tension, David, to the extent to which the government should just leave it in the hands of the military to carry out their policy, hands on or hands off?
This is a very big question. Not only hands on or hands off, but so how far down should the government delve? I mean, after all, they've handed the running of the military over to the military, and the military are supposed to have the expertise to do it. But on the other hand, it is the government's responsibility to ensure that what's happening on the battlefield is in accordance with what the Australian government wants to happen. And so the question then is, how far down should the Minister for Defence or the Prime Minister, get involved? And in the Vietnam War, we saw a fairly hands-off approach by respective Prime Ministers and Defence Ministers until Malcolm Fraser became the Defence Minister. And then he really did want to get down and make sure that what was happening was in accordance with government policy.
Speaking of key advisers, it appears that Angus Campbell is staying on as Chief of the Defence Force.
That is right. I mean, I have no knowledge of the relationship between the new Defence Minister and Angus Campbell, except to say that, according to the press, when they went off to the Shangri-La conference in Singapore recently, and Angus Campbell was there advising the Defence Minister, he was very impressed with the advice that he was getting from Angus Campbell. And shortly after, Angus Campbell's time as Chief of the Defence Force was extended for a further 2 years.
I'm talking to David Horner, military historian and author of The War Game, Australian War, Leadership from Gallipoli to Iraq. And while you say that expert military advice is crucial, it is not the only advice. Enter stage left, a war cabinet.
That is right. In the First World War, we did not have a war cabinet, but in the Second World War, the Menzies government established a war cabinet. A war cabinet is a small number of senior ministers who deal with the running of the war. And in subsequent wars, we have not had a war cabinet, but quite often the government has established a small committee to assist the Prime Minister in these matters. And at the moment, we have one called the National Security Committee of Cabinet. And it was that National Security Committee of Cabinet that decided to get us into the 2003 Iraq War.
David, who's invited to be involved in a war cabinet? I guess the service chiefs.
Well, the War Cabinet consists of senior ministers. We're probably talking of something in the order of 10 senior ministers. You can imagine Minister for Defence, Army, Navy, Air Force, and so on. The service chiefs, back when we had Army, Navy, Air Force, the service chiefs, but now with one service chief, he's not a member of the War Cabinet, but he is invited to come along and give his advice. That's almost a permanent arrangement, but nonetheless, he's there. He's not a decision maker. He is there to provide advice.
David, has an opposition leader ever been involved in a war cabinet?
No, but in the Second World War, the Menzies government established what they called the Advisory War Council. The Menzies government was only being kept in power by the vote of two independents. And so to give the opposition an involvement in running the war, Menzies established the Advisory War Council, which consisted of about 5 government and 5 opposition members. It was not a decision-making body, it was advisory, but it was really important because it meant that the leader of the opposition, John Curtin, got involved in the strategic decision issues And when he eventually became Prime Minister, he was in much better position to run the war as Prime Minister.
And he was prepared to deal with MacArthur.
Well, he was prepared to deal with MacArthur. It's very odd, of course, that Curtin, from the left wing of politics in Australia, dealing with a man from the right wing of politics in America, but they got on well together. And of course, as we know, MacArthur said, "You know, Prime Minister, you look after the rear, and I'll look after the front."
Now, Gorton disregarded the FAD committee to the detriment of good policy making, as you point out. What about Hawke?
Now, Hawke did not have a war cabinet or a national security committee of cabinet, but he did in effect have one in that he had a small group of ministers who got together to decide whether we're going to go to the Gulf War or not. So it was that small committee that decided, and then having decided, they then had to go back to the cabinet to get approval. But that wasn't a really big problem because already this small group had decided, included people like Keating and Beazley and so on.
Now, we're talking wars, but let's do a quick detour to peacekeeping missions like East Timor or Solomon's. Does that also involve some sort of collective decision-making?
Oh, it certainly does. And I was the official historian for Australian peacekeeping. And one of the comments I used to make is that the government, gave more consideration as to whether we were going to go and assist in Somalia than it did to get us into the First World War. And each one of these peacekeeping missions that we've been involved in, I mentioned Somalia, Rwanda, East Timor, and so on, are matters of very important policy that have to be worked out by the government. Do we send our forces away from Australia across the world to Somalia, or do we keep them back in Australia to defend Australia? So they're the sorts of decisions that the government had to make for peacekeeping.
I know you were opposed to the invasion of Iraq as so many of us were. Have we always been on the wrong side of history?
Well, I mean, it's not quite as easy to give an answer, you know, as yes or no on that one. But now, in retrospect, it can see our decision-making process to get us into the Vietnam War was faulty. On the other hand, the decision-making process to get us into the Malayan emergency, as it turned out, we were on the right side. And as the official historian of that period has pointed out, the government got us into the Malayan emergency against a lot of opposition, and it was proved to be right. So on that basis, they thought, oh, we're on a winner here, and applied the same process to get us into the Vietnam War. And, of course, it didn't turn out the same way.
Let's go back to the issues that have bedeviled Australia. One of them is access to Allied strategic decision making.
Now, that is a really big issue because we send our forces off to fight under the command earlier on of a British commander, more recently under an American commander. And in fact, we hand over our forces, and then we have no way of ensuring that they're deployed in the way that we'd want them to be deployed. With that in mind, Prime Minister Billy Hughes in the First World War tried to get into the British-based Imperial War Cabinet to see if he could have some influence there. Again, in the Second World War, Menzies tried to get involved in the British War Cabinet. Curtin tried to influence what was going on with Churchill and Roosevelt. But essentially, they just don't want to listen to what Australia's got to say. And what I have written is that this is one issue that we've constantly got to be hammering away at to get some way of influencing the strategic decision making of our big, powerful allies.
The lesson for Australia is to remain constantly vigilant, and the prime task for war leaders is to manage Australia's role in the alliance. Now, access to intelligence goes with that as well.
Access to intelligence, or more broadly, just information, Remembering back in the First World War, the only representatives that we had overseas was the High Commissioner in London. And therefore, we were relying on the intelligence and the views of the British Foreign Office and so on. But gradually, we were able to get, as years went by, get the representatives overseas. We started to get them during the Second World War. So we get advice from our foreign policy people, but we also need to get advice from our intelligence gathering people. And we've only developed that capacity gradually over the century. And then the big question comes, is the government going to listen to this intelligence that they get? And many people would say the government only wants to listen to the intelligence that, or heed the intelligence that backs up what they've already decided.
That's a very familiar human failing, David. Now, the wilier Prime Minister is able to manage the politics at home, both divisions within his own party and criticisms from the opposition.
I've written in the book that one of the big issues is that the Prime Minister has to manage the politics. Billy Hughes, for example, in the First World War, split his own party, the Labour Party, over the conscription issue. Many people have criticised Menzies' war leadership in the first 2 years of the Second World War. It's not as bad as a lot of people try to portray, but what he couldn't do is manage the politics. And by not managing the politics, he soon found himself out of the job. On the other hand, somebody like Hawke and Howard managed the politics very well. Hawke, of course, had to manage the politics not just against the opposition, but within his own party.
He also tried to handle them with the media. When I started doing this, the first Gulf War was raging, and Bob got very cranky with some of the people we chose to discuss it on the program. So how likely is it, David, that Prime Ministers, perhaps our current one, will be considering all these factors when there is no imminent war?
What I have written in the book and what I've said elsewhere is how does a Prime Minister prepare himself for these sorts of issues? And one way he prepares himself is by sitting in the National Security Committee of Cabinet that we've got at the moment, which deals with the problems of international security. So he needs to become familiar with those issues so that if the situation deteriorates, he's across the issues and doesn't get caught unprepared.
David, I think it's fair to say that one hot tip you give our current leadership is not to blindly follow the US, a view I wholeheartedly endorse. David, thanks for coming on. I've been talking to David Horner, military historian, emeritus professor at the ANU, and we've been discussing his 37th book, The War Game, Australian War Leadership from Gallipoli to Iraq, and it's published by Allen and Unwin. Thanks, David.
Well, thank you very much, Philip.
Oh, and that's your lot for the week. It's time for thanks. Thanks to the listener for listening. Thanks to the team for teaming, E.P. Anna Whitfeld, Anne Arnold, Taryn Priyadko, Catherine Zengara, Jackie Dent, and sound engineers Emrys Cronin and Simon Branthwaite. See you next week.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.